Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter, and today I'm speaking to Stephen Treget, a partner at Oakley Capital. He works on Oakley Capital Investments. That's an investment trust that offers a fairly concentrated portfolio of private equity holdings across three stated sectors of technology, consumer, and education. Like many of the other private equity trusts, Oakley has had a very good pandemic, at least in terms of share price returns. But like much of the rest of the sector, its shares continue to trade on a pretty big discount to the value of underlying assets. So, Stephen, thanks for joining. I thought, given not all of our listeners will be 100% kind of familiar with the private equity trusts and how they work, it'd be great just to start off if you could briefly take us through kind of what your process is, what kind of companies you look for, and, you know, what do you think makes Oakley stand out from the various other private equity trusts that UK investors can get hold of?
Well, thanks for having me on, David. And yes, very happy to kind of initially kind of introduce Oakley Capital at a high level. So I guess, first of all, just to be clear, you've got Oakley Capital, the manager. So it manages funds investing in taking controlling stakes in fast-growing, medium-sized companies in Europe. And that's obviously medium-sized private companies in Europe. And OCI, as we refer to it, or Oakley Capital Investments, is the listed investment trust. And as you describe, that invests solely in the funds managed by Oakley. So it is a listed direct PE play, similar to the likes of a 3i or Apax Global or an HDT. It's got a small listed universe, as you know, in terms of direct PE plays, listed PE plays. And then in terms of kind of overall themes and how we go about our process, and if I was allowed to kind of point out the kind of things that kind of most differentiate us, you mentioned the kind of sectors in Europe. I mean, there are many ways to try to get access to this. It's harder in the public markets, which is the appeal of private equity. But in terms of technology, for us, that is or has developed into being infrastructure as a service. So we happen to invest significantly in web hosting. Certainly, have had a lot of success in that area in the past. And software as a service. And that can be in a broad range of ways, but typically it's software that provides small businesses with a kind of, an unmet need. And particularly trying to build a kind of local champions for small businesses in Spain, for example, or for online merchants in Germany, to give you two, random examples. Consumer, you mentioned. For us, that is typically consumer digital. So kind of online marketplaces, price comparison websites or property portals, and then education. And education for us has been the kind of full gambit of education, starting with private schools back in 2013, but it's now includes after-school tutoring, preschool education, vocational education, and even, kind of compliance training within certain industries. So they're the kind of sectors, pan-European particularly. We've had particular success, not in the UK, but in Germany, Spain, and Italy are probably the kind of predominant geographies. And now we have offices in at least two of those in Munich and in Milan. What's so special about our approach? Because, of course, most listeners will go, well done. Everyone wants a piece of tech, consumer digital education. And there's a lot of dry powder chasing those deals. And so good luck. You've done well up until now. But how do you continue to source and to source at kind of interesting prices? And so if there's one takeaway from our chat is how we kind of manage to do that. And that predominantly revolves around the fact that we work with business founders incredibly well. We were set up by an entrepreneur. The first fund was launched in 2007. That's when the listed investment company floated as well. And his big kind of complaint was, financial partners just don't get what it's like to be an entrepreneur and the challenges you face and what you need support-wise from a financial partner. And so he set out to basically establish Oakley as the financial partner he felt he never had. And whilst that doesn't sound like rocket science, I grant you, you know, kind of relationship-led investing and being empathetic to the needs of an entrepreneur, whilst a lot has changed and institutionalized about Oakley over the next kind of however many years it's been, that has remained at the heart of our business. And how does that kind of manifest itself is that we have now backed some like 20 plus business founders, many of whom have, you know, have not been put off by the process such that they've gone on to do repeat opportunities with us, some now, you know, three or four times. They've actually invested themselves in the Oakley fund subsequently to of the capital we manage in the funds. Nearly 200 million euros of that has been committed by the managers, the entrepreneurs, which is a great, you know, future alignment of interest. Some of these individuals are so relatively wealthy now; they don't really need our capital and our help, but actually, they recognize and respect what we deliver when it comes to, you know, kind of putting together an investment and choose to work with us kind of going forward. What does this all mean? It means that so many of our deals were the first private equity into a company, which is key. So we're expanding the opportunities within the kind of private equity realm. Secondly, there's probably some kind of complexity about the deal. You know, this is a business founder working incredibly hard. They've achieved a certain amount of success. These are profitable businesses, but they are now deep within the weeds of this business. They've got aspirations to do, maybe to do M&A, to internationalize, maybe to digitalize. But they lack the senior management support around them. They don't want to necessarily exit at that point, but they do want, you know, kind of capital to maybe realize some of their holding, but to help them, you know, kind of grow to the next stage. So the business, you know, it may not have proper management information systems, may not even have proper accounts. It certainly doesn't have the infrastructure to support a proper competitive process to either float or be sold to one of the big, large private equity sponsors. And this is where we thrive. So we are coming in at a point where it's messy, for want of a better word. And because we can deal with that mess and kind of navigate the risk associated with it, we get in at really attractive entry multiples. And so we're unearthing hidden gems, companies that may not have even formally touched the financial services sector until now, and growing them, developing. We're often, you know, most of our assets get sold to the larger private equity firms, you know, once we've developed, you know, a business of kind of greater scale. Mm. So maybe to put some numbers around that, I'm going to mention the fact that we are kind of, you know, 90% of deals are kind of with the first kind of primary capital in. 75% of our deals, we are, it's proprietary, i.e., you know, we have sourced an opportunity ourselves through our network, through our relationships, and it's not coming to us via a, you know, kind of competitive or intermediated process. And then I think the best stat we can give, and we can give a whole bunch of these, but our average entry multiple into an asset is about 9.3 times EV EBITDA over the course of our history. And when I tell you that the average EBITDA growth of our existing kind of Oakley portfolio companies is about 35%, the fact that we're able to access that kind of quality of companies at those kind of prices is one of the great appeals. And actually, even today, if you were to buy a share in OCI, and those that have all know this stat well, but there's 22 companies you get exposure to across broadly evenly split across those three sectors. Their average growth, I've already mentioned, over the last 12 months, 35%. We're currently holding them at 12 and a bit times. So, you know, kind of relatively conservatively reflecting the fact that we don't tend to move the multiple much beyond the level that we purchase the companies at. Mm. And then I guess to reassure your listeners around kind of, well, that's great, but how have you really fared in the last kind of 12 months when, you know, there's been a lot of PE activity and a lot of people chasing tech and consumer digital education? I mean, actually, our average entry multiple it is about the same as our long-term average, but actually the growth rates of these companies is actually higher than our average across the 22. So things, you know, kind of we're still proving the repeatability of our model. Don't get us wrong. That's exactly what keeps us awake at night, is our ability to continue to source these you know, really exciting opportunities at great prices. But so far, so good.
So as you said, you perhaps get that mess discount, as I'm now going to coin the phrase.
Yeah, I'm going to regret saying that.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, there's been lots of money chasing deals. And I suppose one interesting aspect of Oakley, and to be fair, many of the private equity trusts, is there has been a focus on kind of companies with fairly significant digital element, which perhaps has helped many of those trusts have quite a good 2020 when we had various lockdowns.
Yeah.
But I mean, you've perhaps covered some of this, but are you not concerned that the, you know, some of that growth is borrowed now from the future, and you
yeah, that's a good got a, question.
A less appealing outlook than you maybe did before?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. Did we just bring forward a number of years of performance that gave a stellar kind of 2021, thanks to the kind of the impact of COVID? Now, there's no doubt that there's, you know, in a couple of the companies that there would have been some outperformance, and has certainly brought us a year or two forward in the business plan. But actually, in some cases, it is essentially it's just triggered the level of penetration that we hoped would start to kind of grow and build. It's introduced a solution to people, and we've seen that actually in some cases, some, you know, we've outside of lockdown, we've continued to kind of keep the pace of growth. So there's a mixture. Some, you know, are clearly not going to keep doubling in size every year. But what examples to kind of give you? Let's think about something that, you know, is an out and out, you know, kind of COVID beneficiary. So for example, Jamondo is an application which provides online fitness classes in Germany. Now, clearly, as less people were going to the gym, more people were looking for at-home solutions. And sure enough, you know, the subscriber numbers have doubled from 250,000 to 500,000. But actually, more and more people are now being drawn in as a result to permanently stay, you know, to using this as a solution. It's a lower cost solution. It's a private solution. It actually, you know, seems to suit and be a beneficiary to women, the service is largely kind of focused on. And also, this was an incredibly nascent industry. I mean, we're barely scratching the surface of this solution in Germany, with a leader by, you know, a long way. Our cost of acquisition comes down as we, you know, get a bigger, you know, kind of market presence. And whilst we may not be able to maintain 100% growth, we are still seeing significant growth levels as a result of this solution gaining greater traction, you know, kind of the impacts of COVID. Now, there are other companies where, and actually, you know, I can talk about some of the, you know, kind of big drivers of NAV growth later if you wish, but let's take, for example, online education. Now, you'd think the big driver of our performance in online education would have been the fact that students couldn't go to a campus. Or if you wanted to come to Europe to study for a degree, you now need another solution. And so IU Group, you know, would have been one of the big beneficiaries of that. However, whilst we may have picked up some growth around that, the reason that this and, you know, other businesses like it, it's solving a need, and people are becoming more aware of that solution, maybe because of COVID. In this case, the majority of the students it takes on are 29 to 30 year olds. That's the average age. The majority of them come from non-academic backgrounds. Again, it's a German business, but it's proving to be an international solution. They want the flexibility of studying for a degree now, whether because they don't have one or because they want a more relevant one. They have jobs, they have families, and they have budget constraints, and this is a great solution. And so their student numbers have grown sixfold since we bought it, to over 80,000, and we bought it in 2018. And that growth is continuing, you know, kind of regardless of, you know, lockdown. I think people are becoming more aware of it as a solution. I think more people are looking to retrain, funnily enough, have taken a different view of life, maybe post-COVID. And so actually there are plenty of triggers and drivers that are that have gained momentum, maybe because of COVID, but it's very much kind of continued thereafter. And there's so much ground for us to make up. I mean, car insurance, I'm terribly boring on car insurance, but the UK now, 80% of car insurance is arranged online. It's a very mature market. You know, we're all familiar with names like Money Supermarket and GoCompare as examples. In Italy, and we are invested in the number one money price comparison website in Italy called Facile. In Italy, before lockdown, 12% of car insurance was arranged online. I mean, the internet penetration and adoption of digital models in, you know, Southern Europe and Western Europe is still some way behind the UK and to some extent Germany. There is loads of ground to make up. Now, COVID may have helped, you know, drive some of that because people then, they didn't have the option of going in person to their broker in the high street who they've gone to for many, many years. And so they've started to consider in that period using a digital solution. But the adoption rate, you know, might have increased to 15%. I mean, there is still so much runway for the companies, and particularly when that's what we're doing. We're not investing in new and fancy, unproven tech. This is very much stuff that you and I are very familiar with. We're just investing in regions that are where we're investing behind that digital disruption curve.
And obviously, not all of your portfolio was kind of aided. I mean, this feels like going very far back now, but in 2020, not all of your holdings were kind of immune to the effects of lockdowns. And I always think one of your better known holdings, at least among people in the UK, will be Time Out. How are things looking for Time Out now?
Yeah, well, in case anyone's not too familiar with it, we invested in Time Out when it was back in the days when it was essentially a magazine. We invested in it with the opportunity we felt to digitize Time Out, to take this great global brand, this wonderful authority on what to do and where to go in cities around the world. And we took what was a 10 million a month audience in what was largely then subscriber, you know, subscription magazine. And grew it to be, to have a proper website, an online presence, social media, etc., and an audience that grew up to about 70 million eyeballs a month. And in doing so, to drive advertising revenue and to kind of create a profitable business. So there was a certain level of success around that. The unexpected success came from Time Out Portugal, and for those that are unfamiliar with it, with the Time Out market in Lisbon, became a phenomenal success. It was essentially, they devised this idea of creating the physical version of Time Out. So the best restaurateurs, bars, and kind of cultural experiences were given a permanent, kind of kitchen or space in this large space, 33,000 square foot ground floor space in Lisbon. And it went on to be an enormous success. 4 million people visit this market a year. It's kind of democratizing fine dining. It's, there's 3 Michelin stars, for example, within the market. I mean, it's phenomenal. And was set to kind of generate about 6 million of EBITDA alone as a market, kind of going into COVID. So that was the, but luck or otherwise, that was the kind of model that we really, began to focus on. And kind of pre-COVID, we opened 5 more markets. And then, of course, COVID came. We had to shut all the markets. And clearly, our content, which was directed towards how to go out, became less relevant. It's not much we could do about the markets other than, kind of control our costs as much as best we could. We reorientated Time Out to be Time In and produce homebound content. And remarkably, the audience actually stayed relatively static, which talks to the power of the brand. And in answer to your question, post-lockdown, what does life look like? Well, as you can imagine, travel and leisure advertising has returned. So the kind of media business is now contributing again at an EBITDA level on a monthly basis since kind of July. The markets are all back open again. We actually opened a new one during lockdown in Dubai, which has been phenomenally successful. And you know, they are. We didn't have them open for too long before we had to close them. But you know, signs are they're returning to kind of prior COVID levels. We're starting to see them contribute again from a profitability basis. And we've kind of strengthened our balance sheet in the period as well. So you know, we've got strong high level of cash. We've got markets kind of open and starting to operate again. Footfall returning, and probably the most exciting thing is the number of landlords and real estate players that are now approaching us to engage with us about the opportunity to open new markets. So the approach we're taking is what we're calling a management agreement, where a real estate player pays for all the capex of the market build, and we are responsible for the curation and the hiring of general managers, and we get a fixed or a minimum EBITDA, which is an attractive level, kind of a minimum of about £1.5 million, or thereabouts, at least. And we have a really big pipeline. The challenge for us is kind of getting around these countries to get these sites to kind of contract completion. But that's our kind of key focus for the growth of this business going forward.
As you say, the performance has been strong, but I suppose one question mark prospective investors may have with this trust, and again with other private equity trusts, is you have these very persistent, quite substantial discounts, which might draw in bargain hunters, but people might also ask, why are you on a double digit discount if you've had 50% return over the last year or so? I mean, we've discussed this before, but how would you explain that, and do you realistically expect that to ever kind of get shaken off, or is that just kind of nature of the beast?
Look, I mean, I think the two things I'd immediately say is that whoever you speak to, Dave, you get a different answer to this, depending on the company, depending on the trust, depending on your size, there's always, a difference. And it's a little bit like there's no smoke without fire. Because there is a discount, I'm now going to come up with some reasons to why one exists, and it slightly perpetuates it. Do I think it will close? Well, I'll own up to being a kind of an optimist. So I think it will. And rather than trotting out, kind of a range of reasons why discounts persist, because funnily enough, there's actually some relatively new investment trusts, and some that are kind of quasi private equity or crossover funds that are actually trading at a premium, and many of them are sitting in cash. So it does imply that there's some kind of inefficiency here at work rather than some, deep underlying issue. I would suggest that commentators that focus on investment trusts in many ways perpetuate the prevalence and the existence and the stubbornness of discounts. And the reason I say that is that, you're typically told to evaluate an investment trust on its value. Like, what's its discount, and how does that discount compare to the long run average? And asking the question as to whether creating not an air of suspicion probably overstates it, but that question mark, why might, a company trade at a discount? And then, of course, as the discount narrows, they say, well, actually, it's looking less value now because of its long-run average is higher than this. And so, you then attract sellers, and then the discount widens again. I mean, to give you a great example of that, in June of this year, so our discount, when I don't know the exact numbers, but went from a 25% discount in January, February, when we announced, the kind of NAV to the end of December 2020. And by June, the discount had in theory narrowed to 10%. And at that point in time, there was a couple of articles in the press saying, OCI's had a great run, and the discount has narrowed to 10%. So it doesn't represent the value it previously offered. I mean, obviously, you can sense the frustration I'm kind of sticking in my throat. But first thing to point out is that was a discount to a NAV in December. You know, we had in that time, you know, the NAV is continuing to grow. I've recognized that the stock market investors don't have perfect visibility to that, but they do have the, you know, they do have our track record. They do have a lot of visibility around what we're investing in and the trends that we're investing behind. The likelihood that our NAV is declining is incredibly unlikely. And so to suggest that the discount, the in reality, as we then went on to prove when we announced our NAV, that the NAV had grown 11, 12% over that period. And funnily enough, the discount hadn't actually narrowed. It was just an old NAV. And you know, here we are again. I mean, it's just the mentality that you acquire a business based upon a trust on the basis of its discount. I think it's completely kind of missing the point. I should push this because it's one of the reasons why many people are drawn to OCI because of the value. It is not the reason I think you buy any investment trust, but certainly not because that's all about market timing, and that's very hard to do. And also, you know, we have less control over the discount and the inefficiencies of discount to NAV that a share trades at, and the inefficiency of the stock market. What we have control over, more control over, is the performance of the funds. That's the great thing about private equity. We're majority holders, we sit on the board, we're active around the strategy, we can create value, particularly around, you know, kind of buy and build, and we've got a greater control over our outcomes. The outcome that matters is the NAV growth. If you look at, you know, what the big drivers of or the best performing PE funds, I would suggest that the level of discount or premium, there's no correlation. Plus, it doesn't even correlate to the dividend they pay. This is a capital growth play. That's why you should be attracted to listed PE and to OCI. And that, fun enough, is the biggest driver of shareholder returns. Now, I do accept that, and we hope that, you know, discounts close over time. And I recognize that, you know, if you can buy OCI on a, you know, 10, 15, 20% discount to NAV, then, you know, that's an extra kicker to the performance if that discount closes. But actually, it's a misnomer if you think that the current, you know, the discount of OCI has closed over the period. It hasn't, because the NAV is still continuing to grow. It's just you haven't been updated. And so, I mean, one of the things we recognize, we've got to be part of the solution here. So we are moving to quarterly NAV updates to try to give a bit more transparency over the course of the year. You know, we continue to do buybacks to kind of provide that confidence in, you know, no one knows more about the quality of the underlying portfolio and how they're performing than the manager and the board of OCI. And they can continue to demonstrate that by buying and cancelling the shares, returning capital that way. I think that's quite compelling. And the more we communicate and the more we have to tell the market about our progress, the better. But I repeat, you know, the reason you buy OCI is because you have an understanding of how we source and originate. You like the kind of areas we invest in, and you believe that the trends we invest behind will continue to drive profitable growth in the, you know, the 22 portfolio companies that we are invested in today.
One frustration that some of our readers do have, specifically with Oakley and with some other names, is that they do want to buy it, but some of them on certain platforms struggle to because it's on the specialist fund segment. Could you see Oakley kind of moving to the main market at some point in the future?
Yeah, it is absolutely our aspiration. So we unfortunately couldn't qualify for the premium list at the time we moved off AIM. So the next best option, certainly as we revised, was to move to the specialist fund segment and at least signal and actually adopt the kind of terms and governance and articles that you would as if you were a premium list, so that we were kind of prepared to make that move. It is frustrating that, I mean, there's a lot of platforms where you can invest in the specialist fund segment. Yeah. There are two where you can't. And I know that's been a source of frustration for people. And we have lobbied those, brokers or platforms to change. but it is our, you know, kind of medium term intention to kind of make that move to the premium list.
Yeah. And just moving back to something you alluded to earlier, at the minute there's lots of money everywhere chasing hot investments, and private equity has been a real part of the kind of M&A binge this year. Would you expect that to kind of pause as we move on into next year, or, you know, what are you seeing at the minute?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think that it is. I think it's slightly overstated in that kind of, because I guess the media, you know, really picks up on, you know, kind of the public to private, you know, private equity, big bad private equity scooping up our, you know, listed assets, taking them away from the access of the kind of man or woman on the street into kind of, you know, the dark arts of kind of private equity. I guess just to address that point, I think it's actually the same funds backing both. I mean, whether it's a public equity fund or a private equity fund, it's still insurance companies, pension funds, it is still your and I money into both angles. So I think it gets a lot more, you know, kind of attention, and so it slightly overstates the kind of size of the kind of private equity binge. That said, so if you look at the numbers in Europe, there's been about 210 billion. That's roughly the run rate for the year that's been invested in private equity opportunities in Europe so far this year. Or sorry, in probably in totality this year. And you're right to some extent that that is probably an all-time high in Europe. You know, kind of certainly exceed, last year was 124 billion, and in 2018 it was 154 billion in kind of, you know, kind of European buyout funds. So it is higher, but also I guess, you know, that is across that's everything. You know, that's kind of angel investing, venture, growth capital, buyout funds like us, and the kind of big larger PE. There's also been a lot of divesting. So actually, in many cases, there's also been a lot of transacting between the private equity funds themselves. So, you know, there's been 190 billion of divestments, probably selling assets to other private equity sponsors or to listings. The other thing I kind of say is that whilst these, you know, they might sound like big numbers, private equity on a global scale is still a relatively small asset class. It gets a lot of attention because I think there is an outdated kind of air of suspicion around it because of the kind of vulture nature of kind of 80s private equity. I mean, most private equity now is a force for good. I mean, I think we created, the portfolio companies that we invested in created 400 jobs last year. When we're not a big fund, you know, there's kind of 22 companies. I think people still have a mentality of it's about asset stripping and cost cutting. Well, actually, in most cases, are growth companies that need capital to help them kind of grow. We're about growing the top line, not shrinking the kind of cost base. I'll get around to actually asking your question, Dave, which is, do I think it's going to grow? And I don't think it can grow at the rates you saw it grow, you know, year on year, principally because there isn't, whilst the funds raised within private equity are continuing to grow, because performance drives more allocation to private equity, drives more investing in private companies, and more companies are being drawn into the kind of private equity backed kind of universe. But you know, the level of investing is going to reflect the amount of money coming into private equity, and it's clearly not going to double year on year in perpetuity. But I think levels can be maintained. And why do I think levels can be maintained? Is that there is a increasing number of companies seeking private equity and remaining private when they may have, you know, kind of used, you know, other sources like the public markets in the past. Why is that? One, 10 years ago, there wasn't access to private equity. It was a fairly nascent industry, existed, but not on the scale it does now. And private equity is available to back companies, you know, all the way through the life cycle. The other thing is, you know, think about what private equity backer offers you in contrast to the public markets. I mean, public markets, and I worked in public markets for 15, 20 years, you know, they are increasingly costly. There's the burden, significant burden of reporting, which grows. There's the burden of regulation. There's the short-termism of investing and investors. There's the fact that you've got a choice. You could take one, you know, kind of engaged shareholder who you get to pick, or 100 new shareholders who you don't get to pick, all of whom will have a very different view of life about what the right or wrong thing is for your company. And most significantly, I think, as a private company making a decision, do you want to give up the information advantage you have by being private, or do you want to tell everyone about your margins, you know, how you, what your future plans are for the business, et cetera, and hand that directly to your, you know, kind of your peers and competitors? I think also it's not just about the availability of capital, which drives more people to seek PE backing. It's about that partnership. It's about what I described. I think we do very well. It's taking a seat on the board. It's providing not just capital resource, but, you know, intellectual resource. You know, helping companies to, what we're particularly good at is digitalization, creating a subscription nature to the revenue base, helping them move outside their local region to internationalize, and particularly M&A, which is something you imagine that, you know, we do well, and, you know, many business founders may not have done that in the past. So there is a increasing number of reasons why the pool of companies grows and shrinks within in public equity, and why the level of activity and investment activity within PE can be maintained.
Just to pick up on one of your points, though, you talk about the, I suppose perhaps it's a competitive advantage if you're private and you don't have to kind of show all to your peers and rivals. But isn't that also a problem? I mean, if you're an investor trying to kind of assess what's going on, and equally, I suppose, kind of perhaps in the era of ESG, you kind of want, you know, that old phrase of sunlight's the best disinfectant, that kind of thing. You want things out in the open. Surely it is an issue.
Well, there's disclosure, isn't there? What are you looking to disclose? I mean, I think one of the things that we have transformed in the last kind of few years is the amount, you know, we will tell you about the companies, to a level that helps you, I think, gauge that as an investor. You don't have to, you know, give up every secret about what the company intends to do and where it tends to do it. But we can at least, you know, particularly address some of the issues you might point on there around, you know, kind of sustainable growth and a sustainable growth, you know, the sustainable way in which a company may grow. The thing I would say is the ESG standards that private companies are being held to, or private equity backed companies being held to, I would argue is higher than the public markets. I think there are standards being adopted within PE that is leading the way, and that's not just by virtue of what the managers want to do. They are signing up to regulation that is, you know, kind of binding them to that. But also, you know, private equity investors are demanding that as part of their, you know, kind of criteria. We are committing to our funds, you know, being of a certain, you know, kind of ESG standard, and that we will publish, you know, kind of KPIs to our investors on all our portfolio companies and, you know, track the improvement or otherwise on, you know, kind of 15 different ESG measures, plus the manager as well, and how it's moving forward. So I actually think the industry is leading the way when it comes to kind of ESG. I recognize that's always slightly going to be, should I, as an investor, I could go and pick my own companies in the public market, and I can get full disclosure, and I can make a decision about the kind of pool of companies. And the challenge being, I can buy a listed PE firm, which gives me exposure to a whole bunch of companies, which I may never have the same level of disclosure as if I was to buy them independently. I recognize that, and that is, you know, kind of one of the challenges, you know, that kind of faces us. And you know, and I think we're doing more and more to address that. I think the big appeal, though, is so many of these companies, you don't have the option to get access to some of these business models. In education, there's barely a listed company in education. And if they are, they're on, you know, kind of incredible multiples. So there is a trade-off, but you are getting access to kind of companies and themes that sadly, either you can't get access to at the moment in the public market on a single company basis, or you may never.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. But thank you very much to Stephen for coming on and talking to us. And thank you for listening. Take care.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.